Hello, you're listening to The Lucky Country, brought to you by the publisher of The Monthly and The Saturday Paper and Australia's first fossil fuel-free super fund, Future Super. My name's Richard Dennis, Chief Economist at the Australia Institute, long-time Canberra resident and first-time podcaster. This is The Lucky Country. Today we'll be talking a lot about the role of government, what it's good at, what it's bad at, what it should do more of, and what we should do less of. I'll be joined later in the episode by journalist Nina Fennell and Union Secretary Natalie Lang to talk about the contracting out of the most sensitive of human services, rape and domestic violence counselling. I'll also be joined by Chris Fry for a new segment called The Sensible Centre. Chris is a bit to the right of me, but we're going to see if we can find some common grounds on some issues nonetheless. The right wing of Australian politics is becoming increasingly confused about what they stand for and what they want. While they talk about the importance of letting individuals make their own decisions, they rage against the idea that adults should be able to decide who they want to marry. While they talk about the importance of freedom of speech, they howl for the resignation of those on the ABC that say things they don't agree with. And while they say they prefer to trust the market than to trust politicians, the modern right winger in Australia has become determined to spend taxpayers' money building coal mines and coal-fired power stations that the private sector says we don't need. Here's what Barnaby Joyce had to say about coal mines.
I just want people to understand this. They say, oh, I don't like coal mines, therefore I don't like coal-fired power. The coal mines are still going to be there. They'll just export the coal to someone else, to another country overseas, that'll put through their power station. So let's try and make sure we keep those coal-fired power stations going, especially Liddell.
For the last 20 years, governments in Australia, Labor and Liberal, state and federal, have largely agreed that the government was involved in the delivery of too many services. And for 20 years, we've been told that if the government got out of the way and let the market work its magic, the results would be good for the economy, good for the budget, and good for citizens. But the days where politicians tell us that the markets make better decisions than elected representatives are clearly over. Malcolm Turnbull, the former merchant banker and small L Liberal, thinks that he knows better than the energy companies that Australia really needs a new coal-fired power station, whether the banks want to fund it or not. Barnaby Joyce, a sometimes advocate for free trade, is adamant that taxpayers should pick up the bill for the Adani coal mine. And even the self-described ultra-libertarian David Lionhelm supports regulations to protect citizens from the noises that wind turbines don't really make.
When the turbine starts up, or the turbines, there's usually dozens if not hundreds of them, they get sick.
The idea that the market could fix everything is dead. It just hasn't been given a decent burial yet. Trigger warning. Today's episode covers some uncomfortable terrain. We'll be talking about rape and domestic violence and the support services available to women. If you'd rather not hear about that, maybe turn off now. I'm now joined by Natalie Lang, New South Wales State Secretary of the Australian Services Union, and Nina Fennell, who's a sexual assault advocate and freelance journalist. Natalie and Nina, thanks for joining me.
Thanks for having us.
Natalie, I'll start with you. Most people think about the profit motive as a way to give firms an incentive to invent new phones or to make a better ice cream. Most people probably don't realise that we're soon going to rely on the profit motive to provide rape and domestic violence counselling services in Australia. Is that really what's going on?
Yeah, Richard, worryingly, that's exactly what's going on. I think innovation's a wonderful thing, but when it comes to services that support our most vulnerable, activism is certainly the best form of innovation, and that's not what we get from for-profit companies. That's what we get from community sector organisations.
So how would the profit motive work here? What is it that we're actually going to ask private companies to do, and why might a for-profit company be better at helping women seeking support after experiencing rape or domestic violence?
Well, it's certainly not better for women, a profit-making company running vital life-saving services such as 1-800-RESPECT. So what's happened at the moment is the federal government has provided the contract for the provision of 1-800-RESPECT, which is the National Sexual Assault Domestic Family Violence Counselling Service, to Medibank Health Solutions, who are a private for-profit insurance company. And what Medibank do is they provide the phone lines and triage workers now for people calling 1-800-RESPECT. So in the past, when someone has experienced rape or family violence, they could call 1-800-RESPECT and speak immediately to a trauma specialist counsellor at the Rape and Domestic Violence Services Australia. Now, when they call 1-800-RESPECT, they speak to a triage worker at Medibank Health Solutions, who may direct them to a fact sheet or a website, or they may direct them for trauma counselling. When they have directed them for trauma counselling in the past, that's been to the internationally recognised specialists at Rape and Domestic Violence Services Australia. But now, in order to maximise their profit from this service, Medibank has gone with the lowest possible tender price and not the best possible service. And that means people are going to be farmed out all over the country for counselling services. They're going to speak to multiple services. They may have to tell their story multiple times. Their files will be shared between those services. And overwhelmingly, that is a worse outcome for women who've experienced terrible violence, and it's simply to maximise the profits of a for-profit company.
So let me get this right. When I think of triage, I think of people presenting at an emergency ward in a hospital, and maybe they speak to a nurse first, and the people bleeding to death get treatment before the people who have unspecified but vague symptoms. So triage is about treating urgent cases more quickly. Are there any cases of women who've been raped seeking help that aren't urgent?
Yeah, I think that's a really good point, Richard. The issue is that anybody who has suffered terrible violence and needs to call 1-800-RESPECT should receive the best support immediately. They shouldn't have to essentially sit an interview to see if they're if they pass the interview to get support. We also know that in this particular area of service delivery, often women who have been raped or experienced terrible violence don't have a lot of trust in the support and systems out and around them. So they often don't call up and say, I have been raped or I have been beaten and I need counselling. They will often call and say, I'm calling for a friend, I'm looking for a phone number. And it's only by having a specialist counsellor as the first responder that the genuine needs of that person can be identified. So I'm deeply concerned about women who may be missing out on receiving the support they need because of this triage.
So when this triage is taking place, you know, I'm an economist, I'm imagining that someone's come up with the great idea that not everybody needs specialist care. If we can give the people that just want some information, or some people that just need to know about some services in their region, if we can just put them on to someone else, get them the brochure emailed out quickly, presumably we can free up the time of the specialist counsellors to work on where they're most needed. Where does that fall down?
Well, it falls down because when 1-800-RESPECT started as a service, and even if we only go back as far as 2012, there were less than 20,000 callers a year to 1-800-RESPECT. Now, because of all of the incredible work that advocates such as Nina and Rosie Batty have been doing to raise awareness about family violence and sexual violence, calls to 1-800-RESPECT have skyrocketed to over 60,000 a year. Now, it's unacceptable that any call would go unanswered or that people would have to wait to receive the support they need. But instead of the government providing the sufficient amount of funding to put on all of the specialist counsellors necessary, they've instead tried to cut corners by implementing a triage model. And that means, yes, some people do need accommodation and advice and referral, but they also need counselling. And I think it makes about as much sense as to say 000, our emergency services are at crisis point and we need more ambulances, so we'll cut the fireys to put on more ambulances. Nobody in their right mind would think that that's acceptable. So I don't know why women who've experienced rape or family violence should be passed around in the same way. If we need more counsellors, you put on more counsellors.
Nina, you've unfortunately had your own terrible personal experience of this. What's your reaction to the idea that women calling these lines are triaged before they get the right to speak to a trained counsellor?
Well, I think it's appalling. I mean, my own experience, which I'm happy to share, several years ago I was randomly attacked, held at blade point, bashed, strangled. I was told I was going to be killed and I was indecently sexually assaulted. And after reporting to the police, I then required huge amounts of counselling, and I'm someone who has over the years called 1-800-RESPECT, and initially when those phones were being answered by trauma specialist counsellors, the support that I received was amazing, not just in terms of managing the impacts of trauma like nightmares and flashbacks and so on, but also just in restoring dignity to me as a human being. And I'm horrified by the changes that have been made. It's now that it's a triage model, and I've called it since it's become a triage model seeking counselling, and the service was terrible. When I called up, effectively what it does to you is it makes you're being forced to audition in front of a non-trauma specialist phone operator, and who then gets to play gatekeeper, deciding whether or not you get patched through to the actual trauma specialist counsellor. And in my case, because I now also work as a journalist and I often report on sexual assault, when I hear really horrific disclosures, I will often call the hotline to debrief. So last year I received a disclosure of a gang rape, and the details of it were unbelievably brutal. And afterwards, I just couldn't stop crying, and I was, you know, I was really, really severely impacted by that story. And of course, I've got my own residual PTSD. And so I called the hotline, and I was on the phone for 50 minutes in tears, and they didn't offer to patch me through to the trauma specialist counsellor. And I found that humiliating, you know, effectively being forced to audition as to whether or not you get patched through to the specialist care, and then not being offered that, for me was, you know, you could probably hear in my voice, I'm shaking a little bit, because it's just not right.
Thank you for talking about this with us. I mean, we've all been forced to go through triage models to get access to support from whether it's our IT in the office or Telstra or any large company, where we say, look, I've got a problem, can you please put me through to someone more senior so I can help this? Are you saying that women calling 1-800-RESPECT now have to persuade someone that their trauma is sufficient to warrant immediate support?
That's exactly it. They're being forced into a position where they have to make a case for whether or not they get access to counselling. The other thing, though, to remember is that, firstly, a lot of people who are calling 1-800-RESPECT assume that the person who answers the phone is the trauma specialist counsellor, and so they immediately start disclosing, not realising that they're actually just speaking to the first responder triage, the secretary, if you will. Now, what then happens is if that first responder counsellor offers to patch them through to the trauma specialist counsellor, they're then effectively required to retell their story all over again to a second person. And what we know is that for someone who has experienced sexual assault or domestic violence, being forced to constantly retell and retell your story is in and of itself re-traumatising, because it's emotionally exhausting, number one. But it also is actually quite harrowing to have to constantly retell your story to different people, and, you know, disclosing repeatedly to different individuals in and of itself is actually quite humiliating.
Natalie, your union represents the people that work at the Rape and Domestic Violence Service Australia, the people that have been providing high-quality care for many years. Those people are going to lose their jobs as lower-priced providers offer a similar alleged service at a lower cost. What's your union's concerns about this?
Well, firstly, we believe that women who've experienced the trauma of sexual and family violence deserve the best possible service, not the lowest possible tender price. And when we're talking about services like counselling services, almost all of the funding these services receive is spent on the wages of the professional trauma counsellors. So for a service to do it at a lower tender price, yes, they are absolutely cutting the wages of those staff. And the workers at Rape and Domestic Violence Services Australia, they are members of our union. They are internationally recognised expert practitioners in this area of service delivery. They have secure jobs, and they are paid fairly for the expert work that they do. Now, the new providers who are coming in and going to be providing that trauma counselling, I don't have a bad word to say about those services, they're wonderful services, but their background is not in specialist sexual assault and family violence trauma counsellors. We know that they are now seeking to employ people to try and do that work. They are employing people at considerably lower wages than what was paid by Rape and Domestic Violence Services Australia. So I am concerned about whether they will be able to get workers of the high calibre such as Rape and Domestic Violence Services Australia. And we also know that the other service providers do not offer one single permanent job for a specialist counsellor to 1800RESPECT. Now, we need to have absolute confidence that our national sexual assault domestic violence counselling service are staffed by the absolute best practitioners. To not be able to offer a single secure job or decent wages raises a very serious concern. Rape and Domestic Violence Services Australia has essentially been defunded for treating their workers appropriately and for having the best counsellors.
So Rape and Domestic Violence Services Australia will effectively cease providing counselling services next month. How much would it cost to keep that service running?
Yeah, this is an absolutely devastating time for our community. Firstly, it's important to know that Rape and Domestic Violence Services Australia was formed as the Rape Crisis Centre over 40 years ago by 500 feminists in the Redfern Town Hall. It is an internationally recognised best practice service. They employ around 110 specialist staff, and they will now be facing closure at the end of October. That service could be saved. It could continue to provide the high-level specialist trauma counselling that it does for just $8
million. $8
million? $8 million, the total cost.
Nina, you're a journalist. Why don't I know more about this? I read the papers every day, and I, until recently, had no idea that we were relying on contracting out for such a sensitive service, that we've introduced a profit motive into an area where the most utmost sensitivity is required. And now I'm learning that for $8 million we could keep it going. Why don't we hear more about this?
It's a great question. I think the reason why we don't hear more about this is because the people who are impacted most, as in those who have experienced rape and those who have experienced domestic violence, while they're privately highly distressed about what's happening to the service, they're also reluctant to speak out publicly to the media about it because to do so would require them to out themselves as a survivor of sexual assault or domestic violence, which, as we know, in many cases, there is still a real social stigma around both of those issues. And it's a huge ask of individuals to expect them to go on public record, firstly acknowledging their own experience and the fact that they're a client of the service, and then to speak publicly about it. So I think behind closed doors, there's actually a lot of distress within the survivor community. I know that I'm deeply connected with that community, and there are a lot of people who are hugely angry at the government for what they're doing. But we're not hearing more about it publicly because a lot of those people are not ready yet in their recovery to out themselves as a survivor. It shouldn't be on the backs of survivors to have to advocate for a service that provides them with basic care. This should be, in our country, every survivor of sexual assault or domestic violence should be entitled to the best quality care and support. And I think it's absolutely disgraceful that the federal government has done this. And I think they're stabbing survivors in the back, knowing that they'll get away with it because they know that too many survivors are silenced by the stigma and shame of their own abuse.
It's bad enough that we're asking women to have to repeatedly describe what's happened to them to counsellors, but to suggest that those same women should have to go public and demand from the public at large that they be treated with respect and given the funding they require is obscene beyond words. Natalie, you've been running the No Profit from Rape campaign for some time now. What's your perception of the media's interest in this issue?
Yeah, look, I'm yet to speak to a single journalist or media outlet who hasn't been completely horrified at the situation. Unfortunately, the media do want to hear from women like Nina who are able to speak, give a human voice to it and speak as a survivor. But just as Nina said, we also have ethical obligations on us, and asking women who are survivors to put themselves in a position where they could be re-traumatised again, which could be potentially dangerous to them, is something that, you know, we just can't do. And so that does make it hard. It does make it hard to get it on the airways. It does make it hard to get it on the television. And that's absolutely what the federal government's relying on. They're relying on not having human faces to this story. But unfortunately, there are 60,000 5,000 women, men and children in our community every year who rely on this service who are being completely let down by the actions of this government. And when we talk about women, men and children who've experienced rape and terrible violence, these are people who have been betrayed by often people that they've trusted, often people that they've really let into their lives. To be betrayed by their government like this is completely appalling. And when they do reach out, when they do get the safety and the confidence to call 1-800-RESPECT, they deserve to have the best possible service there. And that's not a for-profit insurance company like Medibank Health Solutions recording calls and lining their own pockets with profits from the service.
Nina, it must be very hard sometimes for women to pick up the phone and make these calls.
The other thing that we need to keep in mind here is the long-term impact and what that will mean, not just for individuals but also for Australia as a whole, of what it means if women and men and children who call this line are getting sub-quality care. Because what we know is that for a lot of people who have experienced sexual assault and domestic violence, making that decision to pick up the phone and ask for help sometimes takes months or even years. It takes a tremendous amount of courage. And I've spoken to women who have spent months building up the courage to pick up the phone and call 1-800-RESPECT, only to be met with an MHS call operator who provided low-quality care. And the result of that is when they got off the phone, they said, I'm never going to call again. Now, what that means is that's a missed opportunity to support that person towards recovery. What that looks like down the track for that individual, who knows, but it may mean that they never, ever reach out for help again. So one of the things that I'm most distressed about this is the fact that it's not just how appalling it all is, but it means that women who otherwise would have gotten support, would have gotten care, may miss out, and then the long-term impacts of that in terms of their trauma and recovery are just devastating.
Well, I really am struggling to get my head around how a country as rich as Australia could find itself in a position like this. But Nina Fennell and Natalie Lang, thank you so much for the incredible work you're doing to not just raise awareness of this issue, but to work so tirelessly to improve the quality of support that women needing these vital services receive. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Richard.
Thank you.
That was freelance journalist Nina Fennell and ASU State Secretary Natalie Lang. If you or someone you know has been a victim of rape or domestic violence, or today's conversation has made you distressed, please ask for help. You can call 1-800-RESPECT. And now for a new segment, The Sensible Centre, with Chris Fry, longtime Canberra resident, former political staffer, current lobbyist and current right-winger, about why he'll be voting yes and why voting no might be bad for the right. Chris, welcome to the lucky country. Now, Chris, I know you don't care at all about inequality, but I also know you voted yes in the marriage equality plebiscite. Why? Why did you vote yes?
Well, two reasons. Number one, I got it and returned it that night, and we got it very early because I'm pretty famous for opening my mail and leaving it on my desk and then coming back to it months later. So I thought I would get in early. But more to the point, I voted yes, not because I think it's a great injustice or anything else, but I detest the no case, and I wanted to also hoist them on their own process petard.
But what's to detest? You don't care about inequality. Why do you vote yes?
I do care about inequality where I agree with it. I do not think in the slightest that it is a matter of discrimination. That people of the same gender have never been allowed to get married. A lot of people disagree with me, that's fine. But I don't care that they want to get married, and I'm happy to vote to let them get married. But I just don't believe it's a great social injustice. So that puts me in the sort of fascist side of the argument. But equally, the notion that you would die in a ditch, which is literally what these people are doing to stop this. And by the way, they won't stop after the vote is counted if it's successful. That is very offensive to me, and that is un-Australian, especially when they've foisted this ludicrous process on us in the first place.
So you think it's bad political strategy as well as bad ideology?
I think it's a very bad strategy from Abbott, given that he's made himself the putative leader of this cabal. It's a very bad strategy for him. I actually think it will turn out to be quite good for the PM. It won't be a positive for him, but I think it will remove a big negative. It will obviously be good in the long run for people who want to get married. We all know people like that, and good luck to them. But the notion that there is a group of people who can forever dictate to us what we can and can't do, and indeed actually what we can and can't think now, that's a very bad thing. And anyone, in my view, left or right, who believes in sort of freedom of speech and whatever, should be voting yes on this one.
So you think that the Conservative cause is doing itself some long-term pain by adopting nanny statism?
Absolutely. And also, the irony is that they so obviously know how feeble their argument is that they've been lying about ancillary matters almost entirely and quoting people from other countries. There's a Canadian guy I saw in an ad the other day, claiming that the world has ended. I mean, you know, the only thing that people think about Canada, in my experience, is that most young ladies are in love with the Prime Minister.
So I know you hate wowsers when it comes to drugs and alcohol. Are you saying the no campaign are the wowsers when it comes to marriage?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, I'm married, you're married. The notion that it is a threat in some way to anyone's relationship is absurd. And frankly, that is offensive. I would be offended if I were gay and people said that about me. Well, it is a form of wowserism, I agree with you. But it's even worse than that. It's the notion that, you know, we run things and we've always run things, and you're not allowed to change even when there's an overwhelming majority for change. That's what I find offensive.
So that's a tension really between the old-fashioned conservatives and the old-fashioned libertarians.
Absolutely. And you can see it playing out. It's been playing out for two decades in the Republicans in America, and now it's happening here. And I mean, I don't vote conservative, and so therefore politically I love watching this battle occur in the coalition and, you know, within the parties and between the coalition partners. But for Australia, we need to hopefully move on from this and stop this unrepresentative rump from gaining any more ascendancy. And I think this vote is actually going to crawl them. That would be my guess.
So even though we disagree about the why, we actually agree on the what. And I think we've wound up in the sensible centre, despite our inevitable disagreements.
Beautifully put, Richard. I completely agree with you.
I look forward to arguing some more. Thanks for coming on to The Lucky Country.
Thank you for having me.
Now, to be clear, I have absolutely no concern about government stepping in to provide important services. As an economist, I've got no doubt that markets do a pretty good job of making coffee and sandwiches, and a pretty good job of making smartphones as well. But as an economist, I also have no doubt that markets do a terrible job of delivering emergency healthcare, and I'm terrified at the thought that the market might be trusted to figure out the best way to provide counselling services to women who've been raped. The question for me isn't whether taxpayers should own and run everything, or whether they should own and run nothing. For me, the interesting question has always been, which things should government do more of, and which things is it okay for governments to do less of? After 20 years of being told by politicians and business people that the answer is always, unequivocally, the market can do better, the debate has finally shifted, radically. All of a sudden, the parliament's full of conservatives who want to spend public money to create jobs. This is a big shift, and it means that politics is starting to get interesting again. While all politicians now admit the government has an important role to play in the economy, the political class is struggling to explain why some of them simultaneously think that building coal mines is an important role for government, but that providing disability services or rape support services is not. The demise of the car industry provides another good example. Once upon a time, they couldn't care less that the car industry was leaving our shores. Now they say they'll do anything to keep manufacturing jobs here in Australia. But of course, there's no bigger ideological backflip on the role of the markets than that of Malcolm Turnbull himself. While there's been enormous debate about the best way to design climate policy and the role of the market and the role of the state, the fact is there's been almost no debate about the decision to rely on the market, the profit motive, to provide something as important as rape and domestic violence counselling in Australia. These are ideological battles, but they have enormous personal consequences. It's inconceivable that in a country as rich as Australia, we need to scrimp and save in the provision of something as sensitive as rape and domestic violence counselling. As I said at the beginning, the modern right are pretty confused about what they stand for and what they want. On the upside, for people like me who see a positive role for government in the provision of services and in infrastructure, there's never been a better time to make your case. There's now a rare consensus in Australia that well-targeted public spending can grow the economy, create jobs, and make the country a better place. Sure, some people want to spend more money on building coal mines, while others want to spend more money on renewables. Some people want to spend more money giving better support to women suffering rape and domestic violence, and some people want to spend less. But fights about spending priorities are exactly what we invented parliaments to do. Let's hope ours starts having these big debates. That brings us to the end of this week's episode. The Lucky Country is a Schwartz Media production brought to you by Australia's first fossil fuel free super fund, Future Super. You can email us on theluckycountry@schwartzmedia.com.au. Please send in any questions or anything that doesn't make sense or seem true. The show is produced by Andy Hazel. I'm Richard Dennis, and I'll be back with another edition of The Lucky Country next week. Thanks for listening.